Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. Our guest today is Con Klott, VP of Technology of Committee for Children, a nonprofit from Seattle. Welcome to the show, Con.
Thank you for having me.
I often ask folks right up front, what initially got you excited about technology? What was that aha moment where you knew you wanted to get into computers or get into the field?
Well, even as a little child, I enjoyed working with computers, playing with old Atari 400s, Atari 800s, kind of maybe sets my age for some of your listeners. But the real big change happened when I went to university and studying to be an aeronautical engineer and was thinking, well, that's kind of what I wanted to do. I wanted to work for Boeing. And as I started to get into my second and third year of college, I realized with some of the computer courses I was taking that this internet thing is kind of cool, and maybe I should look into that a little bit more. I found that I was working a lot more online and learning about things like the web, which had just coming out right around then, and felt like that was something that I wanted to spend more of my time and energy on rather than your traditional engineering courses and some of the computer science courses I was taking at the time.
So the interwebs got a hold of you.
They did, and it was sort of a very interesting time. I mean, the specific timeline we're talking about is about 1993, 1994. And at the time, the web was not very well known. You could go to Yahoo and scroll through it and read all the new sites that were posted that day. And so it was the very infancy of the web. One of the things that I had the opportunity to do was build one of the first student websites at my university. Back then, there was no Apache software. It was something you had to download from the University of Illinois.
UIUC, Urbana-Champaign?
That's right, UIUC. And so that was another homepage that nearly everyone had booked back then. And so it was a very interesting time. Probably its closest metaphor is to the 1849 gold rush, that the opportunities were just always out there. There was new stuff that was interesting. You'd ask yourself, how do they do that? That's sort of interesting. And you wanted to be part of it. And that's where I found myself as a, between the sophomore and junior years of my college career. And that whole explosion of what's going on the internet and the web was what ultimately got me to say, you know what, I need to drop out and get into doing this as a full-time job.
Yeah, I was supposed to graduate in 94. I went an extra year to do a co-op. Then the economy improved a little. And as soon as I got out, I got to EDS and was working in a big consulting company. And the odd thing I noticed was that every Friday, we were having a going away lunch for someone. And we would always go to Green Papaya, the local Thai restaurant that's awesome, Waltham, near there. And every Friday, someone was leaving. And I'm like, where is everyone going? And there's all these dot-com startups that people were going to. And I was so fortunate to have been in the industry at that time.
I really feel blessed that the timing of where my opportunities opened up and where the internet was going at the time sort of coincided. The interesting thing is that for me, maybe a dimension that was very compelling for me around the internet was that I grew up overseas. I was born in Turkey and I lived there for the first 17 years of my life. And while I'd seen movies like War Games, the idea of war dialing or making any local BBS calls at all was sort of a foreign concept, mainly because the foreign telephone services are typically pay by the minute, no free local calls. And so that's sort of an interesting dynamic about industry and online communication and being able to, for that whole dimension to take off as a business sector in the United States, AOL and CompuServe and all the predecessors to being online that I never got to partake in.
So fast forward to today as VP of Technology at CFC, for folks that don't know, what does Committee for Children do?
A Committee for Children is a 40-year-old organization, nonprofit, and our focus is on delivering social-emotional learning curriculum. Our mission is to serve 100 million children annually by 2028. One of the things that makes it very exciting to work for a Committee for Children is that the curriculum products that we provide to the edtech space has a lot of evidence supporting better educational outcomes for students and improved situations like lower truancy, fewer disciplinary referrals. So in other words, social emotional learning helps students stay engaged on their academics and being healthy individuals in the classroom, as opposed to the sort of strife and things that might come along with the traditional school day if you don't have those skills.
So the last, I'll call it 7 years, we've definitely seen a boom in EdTech. And actually, we've had many EdTech customers, and they all seem to have a few things in common, that they were moving things online or wanted everything to be run online, not be, you know, textbooks and, you know, brick and mortar type operation. And they generally wanted to wrap things in a grading system and a collaboration system and make it kind of one-stop shopping and also some lock-in for their customers. And there's a big emphasis on front-end development. We've done more React development for EdTech clients in the last 7 years than I can even recount. What do you take that, you know, is kind of pushing that focus? Why are the curriculum providers headed there? What's your take on EdTech?
Yeah, I think that the first part is why the recent push. And I think the recent push is that, first of all, education has to be largely driven by public dollars. Education has to be equitable for access. And one of the challenges is that only in recent years has the state of broadband in, for example, rural areas, or even in certain big cities, certain schools may or may not have had the kind of broadband access that they needed. In addition, for certain types of classrooms, typically older students, you have a situation where you may not have one computer per child. And so you need to make sure that if you're producing educational solutions, the computing hardware is cheap enough, and with Chromebooks, especially in volume shipments, getting cheap enough, the timing is right for EdTech solutions to become more pervasive, given those obstacles are no longer in the way. So the front end focus is driven by, I think, a couple of factors. First, on the back end, those components are still required, but maybe it's a little bit easier to outsource some of the front end development externally. The other dimension of it is that the front end needs to be highly usable. As students and instructors are using EdTech solutions, Facebooks and other social media apps, Instagrams and sort, have really set a high bar in terms of what a usable front-end experience looks like. And that expectation is, if a school district is buying it, if a student's using it, it feels like old technology if it looks like the 1995 web we're just talking about.
Yeah, I think our kids have grown up spoiled somewhat in having these beautiful immersive UIs to work with. And I think you're right. We've set the bar where if everything they work with, including something as important as their education curriculum, doesn't look like that, they feel underwhelmed.
Yeah, definitely. And certainly there's also the element of, is it something that they check out of or get bored if the UX isn't where they've grown accustomed to using it? I mean, if you harken back to thinking about products like Encarta or other sort of CD-ROM-based interactives, or even the state of video games, there's an element of, as you go back to look at what those user experiences look like, sort of feels disconnected with what everything else is that you're seeing.
Now, it seems to me there's a few reasons to move textbook to digital. One, like wrap everything together and package it. Two, no used textbooks when everything is bits. So they're guaranteed to make money there. What else do you see as driving the kind of textbook to digital model?
Yeah, there's a lot of dimensions to that. Obviously, the textbook and digital are not the same thing. There are qualitative differences. You know, even today, as you're thinking about, do I buy the audiobook? Do I buy the digital book? Do I buy the physical book? There is a personal preference to what feels good. But some of the advantages of digital, beyond the issue of the backpack strap being too heavy on your shoulder for all the textbooks in your backpack, the benefits of the digital technology is that you are able to potentially provide adaptive learning solutions. So as we start thinking about a lot of big data and machine learning, there are some very insightful opportunities to improve the overall educational outcome by adapting the curriculum to what the student's needs are, based either on a profile of the student. For example, this student might be an English language learner, and so maybe I can use different level of vocabulary for my curriculum. Or it could be actually situational in terms of, well, they answered 3 questions about sine and cosine wrong, so maybe I need to focus in on a little bit more trigonometry instruction to help this particular student succeed.
Now, it does seem, just watching my kids, they go to two different schools, actually three technically right now. One's in middle school, one's in elementary school in the same system, the other's in high school. It does seem like the experience is a little disjointed. Like one of them has a Chromebook, the other one works with a Mac, and that there's different LMSs and that there's kind of a different experience. And maybe even one parent, one kid, you could have potentially different classes using different systems. Do you see that as an issue, and do you see any sort of resolution emerging in the industry?
I think that there is likely to be some resolution to that. I think where you see it most predominantly is probably in higher education, where they can be a little bit more specific about what kind of instruction, what vendors, and what solutions that they are accepting. In the primary school K through 12 space, oftentimes a lot of the curriculum and the curriculum providers that are selected require a lot of parental and school board involvement. And so the fracturing of the various technologies is oftentimes up to those particular local whims. In certain cases with computing equipment, you know, there's probably budget cycles that determine this middle school gets their Chromebooks updated. And so the investment in these Macs needs to continue for a little while. That might explain some of that. There are solutions that are starting to resolve some of the dimensions of the problem because it goes beyond just the LMS. There's sort of instructor preference about how homework is submitted, for example. Some instructors might be using solutions from Google Classroom or from Microsoft, OneNote and that sort of thing to coordinate how the lesson instruction and homework is submitted. Ultimately, where you have a lot of centralization and uniformity is in the school information systems, which is more about the directory information and the overall school management aspect. But the classroom can oftentimes be at the whim of the instructor's preferences as well.
What do you think of the sort of flipping the classroom script? Like I know some places they'll use something like a Khan Academy, have kids learning stuff off hours, maybe watching videos and trying to do some problems on their own, and then using the classroom time really for more what used to be homework, you know, collaborating, doing problems, being able to ask questions. What do you think of it? And do you see that as becoming more popular?
Well, I think ultimately education is something that is really critical to future opportunities. I think everyone would generally agree with that. And the struggles that we've been having with our educational system, despite all the money we're putting into it, you know, we need to try different things, certainly. I think there's a term for the Khan Academy, it's called open educational resources that many teachers bring on or offer, assign as additional sorts of instructional materials are certainly all frequently used and help students. In the end, I think, you know, from my perspective of being in the edtech industry, I like to approach it from a standpoint that there are educational experts that are trying to build these curriculum and try to build them in ways that serve the greatest amount of students in the most effective ways possible. To me, the power of EdTech is around sort of making sure that that's a data-informed journey so that we can start making specific interventions and recommendations as we start to see that students are not performing. That's not to say that those OERs and other resources aren't part of that. They certainly can be. But if we start thinking about it in the sense of, if we're tracking all of the events that the students are experiencing, like they launched this video, pressed pause, there's a 15-minute gap, they read this page, they went back to the video, those sorts of things can be sort of eye-opening as well, whether it's to the teacher, the parent, the student, or the curriculum provider to say, well, it seems like students who completed this video in one sitting seem to learn it better than others. Those are sorts of insights. That's just one example. But those sorts of insights, I think, are compelling for adjusting the curriculum experience for students.
So what would you say the skills are that you think are critical in technology careers?
Yeah, you know, the way that I sort of relate to that kind of question is to kind of think about who are some of the people that I've worked with that have really been the people that I would part with a body part to work with again. And what typically stands out for me is the skills of being able to work with other people, regardless of cross-functional. So reaching across aisles and working collaboratively with your fellow coworkers, not just those people within your department. So social skills are a critical factor. In fact, one of the things that I say is that software is fundamentally social. Now, certainly you can have a sole project you're doing at home or something like that, but There's a reason why we use source control. And that reason is that we're trying to build a ongoing construct together. There's lots of great people out there. Bob Martin, for example, in his books, he talks a lot about how to write clean code. And along those lines, code is about communication. It's about building that shared construct. And if you don't have compassion and empathy for your fellow coders, that's also another red flag that you're likely going to have some challenges on that team. So to me, having your eyes open around what are the things that your business is trying to solve is another factor. For example, if you're just one of the biggest achievements in my career came from an observation about an algorithm of just how to retry credit card numbers. And so the word from on high was, well, we want to try the credit card expirations of 4 years, 3 years, 2 years, and then 1 year out under the premise that the credit card number had reached an expiration point. And the question I asked myself was, with every single one of these authorization requests we're sending to the credit card partner, we're going to get charged a certain amount. And so evaluating which one of those actually had the highest success ratio and putting that first would reduce the overall costs. Over the years of the program, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of dollars it saved the organization, but sort of thinking about not just what are the requirements that I've been given, but what is the organization's goals? What is the project's goals? Keeping those in mind is where the technologist can really stand out from the crowd.
Underserved is brought to you by Syrix, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. Do your kids want to see you at more of their soccer games? Does your daughter want you to come to her dance recital? Does your son want you to help him with his homework, then maybe watch a show together? Of course they do. But it's getting harder and harder for you to have family time because you have to put in so many hours at the office to get your mountain of software projects completed and out the door. And you can't hire people fast enough in such a tight job market to help you catch up. If this is you, then it's time to call Syrinx. We have consultants who can slot into your team immediately to make a positive impact on your schedule. We help you ship software on time and on budget. And we help you get back time to do the important things in life, like having a life. Let us get started today. You could reach us at 888-579-7469, option 1. That number again is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can email us at info@syrinx.com. That is info@syrinx.com. More time with your family, brought to you by Syrinx. Yeah, I often cite an example that one of my instructors, professors used in college. We were talking about the ISO 9000 quality standard. If things had turned out differently, I might have ended up being an ISO 9000 auditor. But in operations management, they would say, you know, you could build concrete life jackets and we could ISO 9000 certify those and say you use the quality management process in order to build these concrete life jackets. Now, from a practical perspective, are they good for flotation? Are they life-saving? Not so much. And that's where someone in more of a consulting role can help you think about what does this mean to my business, as opposed to just kind of blindly going at, like you said, the 4 year, 3 year, 2 year, 1 year retryer and coming up with a good solution.
So I actually have a strategy that I don't know if I've got the best marketing label for it, but I call it resume-driven career development. And what that basically means is that whether you're looking to write your resume and focus on the things that accomplished at a previous position, or you're already happily employed and you're looking to figure out what is the value add I bring to this organization, is to think about how you would write what you're working on in your resume. And one of the things that I look for when I review resumes of people that are applying to positions is, what do they accomplish? So for example, I'm less interested to find out that you managed a cluster of 1,000 Linux servers. I'm far more interested if you did that because it ended up saving your company hundreds of thousands of dollars in hosting costs by migrating from data center to cloud. It's even more impressive if you say that you helped a $50 million project stay on track, on budget, by migrating these systems and configuring auto-scaling or whatever else. So put it in the context of, what did your organization benefit from your effort? Now, that is something that I think can also be forward applied, right? That if you're certainly given a project, imagine you're at the beginning phase of that project and someone says, I would like you to migrate these 1,000 Linux servers to the cloud, lift and shift kind of a thing. Ask yourself, well, why are we doing this? What's the benefit? Why does the organization want to do this? And then start to think about it in those terms. And before you know it, lift and shift that says, well, look, we need 1,000 EC2 instances, all at the same capacity level. You start asking, well, wait a minute, these servers are not particularly well utilized. And maybe more than lift and shift is warranted here. Maybe what we want to do is start thinking about how can we build Kubernetes clusters in the cloud, or use ECS or Fargate or whatever the technologies are that you as a technologist can add value by saying, have we thought about doing it this way? What that then allows you to do is essentially make sure that those more ambitious bullet points are what the company is striving for, rather than the sort of more mundane move these things into the cloud element.
Now, you mentioned some DevOps / SRE terms there and AWS EC2 instances. What's your kind of philosophy on DevOps? We've seen an awful lot of demand for it. Pretty much every customer wants DevOps and SRE folks. What do you think is kind of the right amount of DevOps? Do they lean more towards ops? Do they lean more towards dev? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and one that I think most people are grappling with, because I don't think there's really a universal answer. It sort of depends on where you're at. I mean, I can give you a prototypical sort of a scenario of how I sort of characterize how a lot of these terms kind of came together, and also speaks to some of my biases. But I think when you have two teams and you've created a throw stuff over the wall kind of mentality, that's traditionally been sort of the grappling between dev and ops, right? And what typically comes out of traditional organizations that are organized around a dev and an ops organization is that the operations people are saying, well, the devs can't touch production because they tend to break things. And the devs are saying, man, those operations people got everything locked down, so we can't actually do any of our work productively. So the premise of DevOps, to my mind, is that DevOps shouldn't necessarily be a department in your organization. DevOps should be a culture that speaks to, do the developers have operations empathy, and vice versa. Now, obviously, the best way to build that sort of empathy, in my mind, is to take a full stack or zero ops type of focus. And when I say full stack, a lot of people define that as essentially between the database and the front end. To me, if you're talking full stack, you're talking about the infrastructure and production and monitoring, and you build it, you own it kind of thought processes. And so one of the things that I think builds that kind of ownership very quickly is essentially that if you're building it and you don't have the empathy for customers, you know, one way to get that behavior corrected is that you're the one that's getting woken up when the monitoring is ringing off the hook. But really, to me, it's just about any given process, any given team can't go to zero ops overnight. You know, if you have these rigid relationships between your operations and dev teams, as a question of how do we break down the silos? How do we make sure that the skill sets, the capabilities that the operations team have, the drive for the developers to deliver software, how do we find ways of that working more effectively together?
And how would you say diversity, both spelled with a big D and a little d, is important in the software industry?
Yeah, you know, by big D diversity, I think that what that really harkens to is the idea of what the standard equal employment kind of protected classes are. The little d diversity, essentially the dictionary definition of just different perspectives and thoughts. And that little d diversity includes things like neurodiversity in terms of thought processes. There's lots of people out there that bring lots of experiences. And what is another element of any sort of interesting software problem is that you're trying to solve an issue that if it's already a general purpose solution, you can just use a library for. So there's lots of ways of looking at a particular problem. And the more diversity you have on your team, the more perspectives and opportunities you have to find novel and useful solutions that could really make a difference for the problems you're solving. Now, from one of the observations that I mentioned Bob Martin earlier had made was that the number of software engineers on the planet is doubling every 5 years. And what that fundamentally means is that half the software engineers have less than 5 years of experience. Another observation I think that comes from that is that there aren't enough computer science departments to fill all of those positions. So alternative paths into software engineering careers is going to become more and more common. and that sort of more traditional sort of, you know, having grown up with computers their whole lives, never really thought of themselves as computer programmers, becomes an element of the modern software workplace. And then another dimension that I think is really a factor in building diverse teams and diverse perspectives is how do they have a very warm and welcoming environment for them to join the organization. If you have a programming culture, for example, has been parodied in certain circumstances, is that an inviting place for someone who is just making a career transition? So some of the coding schools in the area, for example, might be catering to people who are transitioning either out of the military, so hiring veterans, maybe starting to get sick and tired of being a flight attendant. Flight attendants, I think, have a lot of empathy for customers and a customer service focus. But if they're tired of flying around and being away from their family, maybe a software career is right up their alley. So inviting those people who are looking to change careers and get into the coding space is important for organizations to realize. And not everyone that you have on your team needs to have that CS degree.
So you've worked in both for-profit companies and now a nonprofit. What have you seen that's different between the two from implementation, budgeting? What's changed for you?
Well, one of the things that I feel is a little bit different is, you know, I've sort of admired one thing that Jeff Bezos has stated about how he runs Amazon, which is that we're willing to be misunderstood for long periods of time. And what I've sort of ascribed that to is that they're not necessarily driven by any given quarter or financial results, and that they're really focused on the long game. So I think that as a nonprofit, we have our vision and our mission that drives us and drives a lot of the decisions that we make. So it puts us in a similar sort of longer phase decision-making construct. I think it's much easier to advocate that we're pushing in the interest of the customer, that we're pushing in the interest of the audiences that we serve, whether they're teachers or students. So some of those are qualitatively different in a nonprofit organization that enables sort of different decision-making on different kinds of timelines.
So it was you that introduced me to the concept of otaku, or which is originally talking about young folks in Japan who are super into anime, like sometimes to the detriment of the rest of their life, but also has been broadened in definition to just mean a lot of technical, somewhat geeky folks getting really into hobbies, which my wife, I have to have a lot of sympathy for. She's been very patient with my barbecue and golf and more recently podcasting and video hobbies. But you mentioned that you had a hobby doing some custom LED lighting.
Yes, that's something that I kind of got caught into. You know, I always had a little bit of a love for electronics since I studied electronics in college and TTL logic and that kind of stuff. And so there's been some recent developments since I last looked at the state of that kind of custom Christmas light show kinds of stuff. And they've got some really great solutions out there, including these microcontrollers that allow you to control these individually addressable LED lights. And that's sort of a fun project to get into because there's all these elements of figuring out how are you going to power these lights? How are you going to find a solution? Because you don't just buy these off the shelf. You know, almost every installation is a custom kind of a thing. So there was a whole bunch of research I was doing into aluminum channels and which LED light strips to get, what voltages to get, because if you get a certain length, you have to do power injection, as they call it, at various stages of the light strips so that the light intensity from each of the LEDs stays consistent. So there's lots of sort of hobbies that I dip into like that from time to time. But what I really love about it is that it sort of reminds me of the early days of the internet where you could just start researching something and you look into HTTP and how do cookies work. And before you know it, you know the protocol inside and out. With this custom LED project is sort of like a reminder of how does DC electricity work? What's voltage drop? What is the appropriate voltage to buy for these lights? How do I mount them to my house? How do I run the power? How do I run the signal? How do I solve all these sort of logistical problems around getting these long aluminum channels onto my eaves without having them snap in half? So it's just a bunch of fun little problems that you have to, I think the closest definition of otaku in English is geek. So how do you geek out on those sorts of little minutiae to be successful on your project?
So what are the actual microcontrollers you're using? Are they like Raspberry Pi or something else?
You can certainly use Raspberry Pi controllers. There's also some custom ones that are purpose-built for that. The one that I'm using is a Falcon controller. The reason I went to it is that most of the forums were talking about how it was the sort of ideal option for not only being able to signal the lights, but also drive power to them, and made a lot of the terminology for telco about the 0 mile. So I guess this would be the first meter problem, that right out of the gate where the power comes in, how do you start signaling and sending the messages to the lights? And that particular microcontroller for the scope of problems I was looking to solve was right up my alley.
Only light strips I've seen, like my daughter wanted to get, name of the company is like Govee, G-O-V-E-E, and they'll sell you this 5 meter strip of LED lights, and they look like little blisters on top of like a tape that you can take the backing off of. You can stick these to something, and then at the end of it, there's a little controller. And then you can put an app on your phone and you can change the color of the whole strip, or you can have it disco and you can have it respond to music, or you can hook it up to Alexa. How does yours work? Are the individual lights addressable, or are you kind of telling the strip to do something? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, they're individually addressable. I think that particular solution you're talking about, which I'm not deeply familiar with, but sounds like a package solution of 5 meter strip that gives you individual control over every pixel. So, for example, you might be even be able to use that, although the coordination would potentially be sort of complicated, is imagine laying 5 of those strips in a linear fashion so that you create a 5-pixel array. And you could even write letters and words with that if you programmed each individual strip from 5 different phones, perhaps. So I think that that's sort of limited to a 5 meter strip of a single line. With the software and the controller that I'm using, I have the ability to say, well, these 6 strips are in a conical fashion forming the shape of a Christmas tree. I could create arrays, very high resolution arrays of, you know, 1 pixel per 1/2 inch kind of a thing, or even higher density as well, I'm sure. But create these arrays and program them to do all kinds of things, like here's a comet streaking across this array or whatever else. My particular setup is set up so that I can have any arbitrary length by seaming these 5 meter strips into whatever length. The ones that your daughter was using, you may see areas where you can cut the strip from the manufacturer. The ones that I bought certainly have that capability where you can introduce a cut wherever you need it and have these custom lengths. So in my particular layout, I have it under all of my eaves to within 1 or 2 inches of granularity. And then each individual pixel can be controlled in this RGB intensity however I want in whatever sequence I want. So it looks a lot like the software I've been using this year. I might change and look at other options next year. It's called X-Lights. And with X-Lights, it essentially looks like a lot of these MIDI sort of music programming kind of interfaces, where it's like this channel contains these lights, I want it to have this color. And what X-Lights gives you the ability for is sort of like Apple and their Apple Loops and their music in GarageBand can say, run this sort of a loop over and over again. You can do those kinds of things that says, well, brighten up the intensity and hide it. So I'm in Seattle, so if I wanted to do a Seahawks thing, I can do blue-green kind of alternating patterns that come prepackaged that make programming the lights that much easier.
Huh. I think your spiritual brother lives in my hometown. There's a guy that does a Christmas tree display. He has 63,000 lights on his front lawn. I don't know if they're individually addressable, and I don't know if they change colors or if he cleverly wraps multiple strands and then just tells one to light up at a time. But he has this display, and you pull up near his house and you put your radio on like 89.3, and he broadcasts the show that's on a loop with music, and all the light controllers are set to the music, and there's stuff going on and off, and it's quite something to see. And in the run-up to Christmas, it's like you can't even get down that street. They have cops there directing traffic and like kicking people out after 10
minutes. Yeah, wow. Yeah, I'm certainly not to that level, at least not yet. That is certainly a labor of love. People who are into that kind of a hobby, when I tell them that I started my project in mid-November, will realize that that's way not enough time to complete it in any reasonable amount of time. So by the time Christmas rolled around, I only had my lower eave set up and still debugging issues with what did I do wrong with the wiring and that sort of stuff. So it is a labor of love. And if you want to get into something like that, give yourself at least 6 months.
Yeah, but then you got the next season and you make it a little bit better and a little bit better. And the next thing you know,
Yeah, that's how I got the hook, I guess.
Well, Con, thank you very much for taking the time to join us and for being patient working with me and Squadcast in order to get the remote logistics worked out.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And we'll look forward to speaking to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.